Escaladores combines two words. When translating from Spanish to English, climbers and scalers. Climbers, because they climb mountains of difficulties and prejudices and mountain ranges of impossibilities. And scalers, because they manage to scale their initial idea.
La empresa que acaba de reemplazar a Yahoo en el Nasdaq 100
also
vale más que la mayor. Se llama Mercado Libre.
MercadoLibre.com, un sitio de internet.
An idea is always important, but much more important is to put it into practice and make it grow, even in contexts that seem adverse.
Mercado Libre, a giant.
Climbers and Scalers is the story of people who think they can. Reaching the summit is not only touching the top, but also enjoying competing in the most challenging league with the best in the world. This is the story of Mercado Libre, told in first person by its protagonists. This is Climbers and Scalers, narrated by their own professional AI clone voices, with full authorizations.
La facturación de Mercado Libre en Argentina equivale a la de los 10 principales centros comerciales del país.
Mercado Libre, congratulations.
Hernán Casá is the co-founder of Mercado Libre. It was not easy to get in touch with Hernán. When I told him that I wanted to reserve 2 or 3 hours to talk to him in peace, he told me that not even for the best CEOs of their companies, he give them that kind of time. When I told him I wanted to do it at the end of the day, when he had no other activities, he told me that he always had activities, from watching a movie on Netflix, reading a book, or going to sleep. Hernán is now one of the managing partners of the investment fund, Casec Ventures, which has invested in some of the most promising companies in Latin America. But before that, Hernán was a public school student and a typical representative of the middle class in Buenos Aires.
Yes, I was born in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. I lived all my adolescence and youth there. I went to a public school. In high school, I went to the Nacional de Buenos Aires, and then I studied economics in La Universidad de Buenos Aires. I studied economics because I like business. I also like numbers and mathematics and the macroeconomic concept of history. My mother is an architect, and my father was an employee of what was then the state's utility company. When I was a kid, first I fantasized about the typical things kids do, like being an astronaut, a policeman, or a fireman. But later, when I was a little older, but still a child, I remember playing with the trucks and the little cars, but I used to play that I was the owner of the truck company instead of being the one driving the truck. Somehow, something that I liked already around there, and well, little by little, I turned to that side. My first work experiences were more on the macroeconomic side. I studied sectors while I was a student and getting into the financial area. I always liked it, and I think now I ended up having an investment fund. And when I was about to graduate from college, that's when I started working at Procter & Gamble, which was a very good school for me. And somehow when you entered Procter & Gamble in these young professional programs, they gave you a small business where you oversaw one of the company's brands. And that's when I realized that I liked running an operation. It was a micro operation within a giant company. But well, in that way, I was seeing a little of what it was like to manage a business. And that's when I realized what I wanted to do going forward. I was working at Procter & Gamble, and I was doing very well. I liked it on the one hand, and I was learning a lot. And on the other hand, the organization seemed a bit too bureaucratic. Big corporations are obviously successful because they have many processes. But when you are at the beginning of your career, and you must go through too many of those processes to make a few decisions that seem obvious to you, sometimes at that moment of youth and rebelliousness that did not fit me at all. Then I started to look for alternatives. I think I always fantasized about going to study abroad and, well, I met someone who was going through the MBA application process. And I became interested in that, and almost without realizing it, I got into the process of preparing the exam, making the application, and ending up studying at Stanford.
With a bit of modesty, Hernán avoids mentioning that he was not an average student at the University of Buenos Aires. On the contrary, he graduated as economist magna cum laude, that is, with honors for being among the highest averages of the university, something that surely helped him a lot in his time at Stanford University, where some names were waiting for him that were going to change his mind and the course of his career.
Yes, I think that my primary and secondary university education in Argentina gave me a very good foundation. The first time I left the Argentine public education system was when I went to Stanford, and I didn't feel the best, but I didn't feel the worst either. I really felt that I was comfortable there. I didn't speak English very good, and I had to learn it later, so I struggled a little bit with that. So I really think that without that foundation, I wouldn't have been able to do the next thing. Stanford is a very particular university where everybody's involved in entrepreneurship, innovation, and technology. Stanford was very particular. I don't know if I would have done the same if I had gone to another university and at that moment, because that moment was like I told you, if I'd gone to Stanford 2 years later, maybe yes, because it was Stanford, but with less chances. But that moment was like the perfect combination of Stanford at the time when the technology world was exploding. I was struck by the fact that all the professors were not just professors. They were professors, and at the same time, they were involved in two or three projects. Those who were more engineering and developing some technology, those who were more business and investing or being, I don't know, directors on the boards of technology companies. And my classmates, the ones who were American, were the coolest ones who were in the business long before me. They also had and went to college, and then they left and went to work in a small place with a friend because they were developing a web page of, I don't know what. It was a very effervescent world. And all those who came to speak, not all, but 80% were related to technologies. I had classes with Steve Jobs, a picture there with my friend Martin de los Santos, with Steve there. I have it on my desk. I had classes with Bill Gates, with Warren Buffett, with Jerry Yang from Yahoo, who today is an investor in our fund. I had classes with several people to whom I would never have had access if I had not gone to Stanford. And the truth is that having firsthand contact with these people was very inspirational because you say, wow, how amazing this person is. But on the other hand, when they tell you how they did it and when you see them there in the flesh, they are more like us than different. Obviously, what they have achieved is unique, but it is not that a Martian appears to you and then you say, well, because he is a Martian, he achieved this. It is a similar person who achieved something that looks like a Martian did it. That also kind of encourages you. And I think that's kind of the point. I think that when we come from the Latin education, in general, it's a little more conservative with very good bases. As I told you, that base was the one that allowed me to get to Stanford, but more conservative. From one, I go to two, and from two, I go to three. And it is not that from one, I go to 100. Because first, it seems that you will never achieve it. And second, it seems that it is even incorrect, like rude. And these people help you a little bit to disrespect that linear process and to encourage you to think in exponential. Two talks that I remember very much from my time at Stanford. One is by Scott McNeely, who is the founder of Sun Microsystems. Sun Microsystems is a company that was born in a dorm at Stanford, Stanford University Network. The guys started it while they were there, and one time they got kicked out of the university because they were sucking all the bandwidth out of the university. I remember Scott McNeely telling his story, which again, also extraordinary. At Stanford, the program is 2 years, and usually in the summer you get some work experience, and the guy went to work for a company that sold dog food. It's not like that summer he went and created, I don't know, SpaceX with Elon Musk, and they were sending rockets to Mars. And the guy says, well, but then I got so excited that I went to a community college at night to study computer science because I had no idea about computers. And you say, wow, this guy is a genius. What he did is extraordinary, but he wasn't born a genius. Another one that I remember that really caught my attention, I don't even remember the name and I feel sorry for him because it's a talk that I remember very vividly. A person who worked, I think, at Oracle. And he came to a class that was a class where we saw a case. And at the end of the case came the person who had been involved in that case. And it was very good because there we were playing smart students trying to generate hypotheses about what had happened. But this guy came in and said something like he was an entrepreneur and he had been at Oracle for a long time. And I think he had done two or three startups and failed until the second or third one was successful. He says that in his years at Oracle, he was doing well. He was an executive that every year had his promotion, and he got a little bit of a raise in his salary and a little bit of a bonus. And every year after the bonus was paid, he would say that this year I'm leaving. But then he says, well, I'd better stay one more. He wanted to start his own company, and he constantly had this dilemma. Not this year, better next one. And one day, he stopped the ball and said no. There are two things that happen here. Either the entrepreneurs are guys who have balls, and no matter how much they get the biggest bonus and the biggest salary, they say, I am going, and I'm going to try to make my dream come true. Or the entrepreneurs are people who do not have a position as successful and brilliant as the one I have, so as they do not have to lose that, they dare to start a business. So, if it is the first case, I don't like to be called a fearful person, so I'm going to dare to do it. And if it is the second case, I have a competitive advantage because I'm better than the average employee, so I will have a better chance of doing well. So, I'm going to go for it. And the guy took the plunge and later told his miserable story of what it was like the first time he hit the wall and said, "Oh, I made a mistake." But well, like all entrepreneurs, he did not get too depressed and he said, "How can I get out of this?" And that's when he created his second company. And I don't remember if it was his second or third company, and finally he was very successful. But I think that's what it is. It's that it encourages you to do things.
Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and so many others inspired Hernán to break inertia, to disrespect the system of doing things sequentially, and to think exponentially, to take risks. It was all very well in theory, but Hernán and Marcos were trying to create something that had little precedent in Latin America. What could be done?
In 1999, entrepreneurship was almost like being a dreamer because there was no ecosystem. There were no other entrepreneurs to draw inspiration from, or almost none. There were not many investors from whom to receive capital. There were no internet users. At that time, the internet penetration was 3%. It was all dial-up and an absurd speed. No, there was no broadband, obviously, let alone mobile internet, which is what has really transformed the industry, so it was very different. Today, entrepreneurship is still a difficult path, but today is much more accompanied. First, because you probably know other entrepreneurs, or you have a friend, a cousin, or an uncle who is starting a business or is part of a company that is starting a business. Then the endeavors of this world today are much more developed institutions that have much more resources to support entrepreneurs. There are like angel networks that can provide the initial capital. Then there are already quite formal funds that can start providing capital to companies in the next stages. Obviously, there is us. There was no CASIC when we started. And also today in Latin America, everything in the technological world is on the radar of the main investment funds in the world, of the main technology companies in the world. In the early days of Mercado Libre, when we were going to present to third parties outside our region, whether they were strategic technology companies or investors, the first part of the presentation was to tell them what Latin America was, what kind of people lived in Latin America, why we believed that Latin America was an interesting market for technology. Today, entrepreneurs can skip all that chapter because beyond the particularities and challenges that Latin America has, the global world understands that all the technological trends that happen in the United States, in Asia, are happening in Latin America, and that it is an interesting market where very interesting companies are emerging, with Mercado Libre leading the way, but now many others like PagSeguro, Stone, XP, Nubank, Kavak, Bitso, and Notco. Marcos, in the second year of the MBA, and I think probably in the second part of that second year, began to work on the idea of Mercado Libre, which was initially inspired by the eBay model, trying to bring that concept of the marketplace, the buying and selling platform, to Latin America. And at that time, I was working on another technology project as well, which was something more related to what today would be chats or message boards. And as Marcos was thinking about this Mercado Libre platform, and I was working on the other one, we exchanged some ideas, and we went little by little, each one advancing in parallel in their processes. And at a certain moment, Marcos, little by little, was convincing me and taking me. First, asking for help in some basic things, and then in some things a little bit more complex. Until one day it happened naturally. I don't remember a turning point where one day I turned the page of the project and got on Marcos' project, which was Mercado Libre, but it happened over the course of those weeks in a very natural way. And, well, when we graduated, we started Mercado Libre, already full-time. I remember that I had planned to take a trip. It is quite typical when you graduate from the MBA or from these universities to take a trip half around the world, trying to take advantage of the last days of freedom you have before embarking on a life of responsibilities. And I remember that I had planned a trip to Southeast Asia. It was a typical destination at that time, but well, I cancelled that whole trip. and we went back to Buenos Aires and we started with Mercado Libre.
Hernán canceled a trip to Southeast Asia, but started a much more important trip, the Mercado Libre trip. Where were they going? Who were they inspired by?
At the beginning, I think that we were a little bit orphaned because we had no one to copy. Maybe there were, I don't know, Amazon in the United States, which is not the Amazon we see today. They were bigger companies because they were in a market that was clearly larger, but they were not consolidated companies, successful as they are today. Our inspiration came from our desire to do things. I remember that I was very excited when someone came to me and told me that they had sold such thing or bought such another. Sometimes when you create these online businesses, which at the end of the day are lines of code, it is software, everything seems a little ephemeral. But when friends or acquaintances came and told you that they had bought, sold, and so on, small businessmen started to appear and built their small businesses on Mercado Libre and said, I work and I feed my family thanks to what I sell on Mercado Libre. It's amazing. We started to see that there was something real, that it was happening, and we realized that it had an enormous potential, that there was a lot missing, but an enormous potential. And as it always happens with these things, I think you think that things are going to happen faster. If we look at the business plan we made at the end of 1999 to raise capital, the truth is that the objectives we had for the next 2, 3, 5 years happened, but they happened much later than we thought. But then you also don't manage to gauge the true potential of what you are doing. It usually happens that they end up happening later than you think they will, but they end up having much more impact than you imagined. And that's what happened with Mercado Libre. Why did we say that day zero should be something regional? On the one hand, because we may have had big ambitions, but also because at that time, the internet market in Argentina alone was minuscule. So the only way to have a little bit of scale was to plan something regional that included Brazil, Mexico, Colombia, or Chile. In technology businesses, scale is very important because it is precisely the beauty of these businesses, of these business models. Because your costs are constant regardless of whether you have one user, 100 users, or 100,000 users. But obviously revenues are proportional to the number of users you have. If you have one user or 100 users, obviously, the one with 100 users has 100 times more income than one user, and the one with 100,000 users has 1,000 times more income than the one with 100 users. So it was worthwhile precisely to be able to take advantage of the scalability of the technology, to think of something big, because the cost of operating only in Argentina would be quite similar to operating in Argentina and Brazil, and in Mexico, and in Colombia, and in Chile, and in Uruguay, and in Venezuela.
It's not for nothing that this podcast is called Escaladores, in honor of those who set out to climb the most difficult mountains, and also in those who think on another scale. Exponential thinking. Not to stay in comfort, not to stay small, but to think big. Mercado Libre's journey had to go very far. Of course, for that journey it was necessary to get financing.
Mercado Libre had basically two big rounds of financing. That would be Series A and then Series B. And the two stories are very different because the first one, Series A, was at the time when NASDAQ was flying and everybody believed that the internet was going to become the new wonder of the world. And I really remember it as a fairly easy process. We almost had to pinch ourselves to believe what was happening because there was a particular investor that we liked, which was Chase Capital Partners, at the time was an arm of Chase Bank that later ended up being JP Morgan Bank and seemed to be the most successful investor in Latin America at that time. So we went to see them and we met. And yes, we were delighted. They told us, we are going to invest and here we want to put $6 million for, I don't know, 30% of the company. And we didn't have anything. And we said, wow, we did the maths and we think we are worth $12 million. That's crazy. We had several investors very interested in investing. We ended up doing the round with two, with this Chase Capital Partners, a person who is still very connected with Mercado Libre, and even with our fund, who is Susan Siegel. And then we also did it with an investment fund from Texas, Hicks, Muse, Tate, and First, which was one of the first funds that Marcos talked about the idea long before Mercado Libre existed. John Muse, one of the fund's founders, told him, If you do this, let me know and I will invest. Well, since that did happen, Marcos called him and reminded him of that. We had a friend who had started working in that fund, so it was also very easy. That first round was at that moment of euphoria where, for a couple of Stanford students, it was very easy to raise capital. And well, almost without realizing it, all of a sudden we had $7 or $8 million in the bank, and we started investing in this regional growth that we wanted to do.
Everything was going smoothly with a couple of ideal investors and $7 million that appeared easily, as if by magic. Susan Siegel, one of those investors, doesn't agree so much. It wasn't easy, it wasn't magic, it was something else entirely.
I came out of what was Chase Bank and went to Chase Capital Partners. And Chase Capital Partners was a part of the Chase organization that did real investments, venture investments, supported entrepreneurs, and so on. And I came from the bank to develop investments in Latin America, private equity investments. Chase Capital Partners had an investment with a group of venture capitalists called Flatiron Partners, and they were investing in Yahoo and in several technology internet companies at that time in the United States. I was doing Latin America. And one day, an angel investor arrived at the office with Fernando Espuelas. Fernando Espuelas was the entrepreneur who founded Star Media. And the partner in charge of Chase Capital Partners said, "Susan, you know Latin America. Wilson, you know technology and internet. You two must make more or less a partnership, a joint venture. Get together with Fernando and see what he thinks, because together you are the perfect person, but separate you don't know the other side." And we got together with Fernando Espuelas and the regional investor with him, Jerry Rosenkrantz, who was the angel investor. And the interesting thing was that meeting, because when I met Fernando, I said, "Look, this is going to change Latin America. Look, this is going to change Latin America completely because we are democratizing information." And always in Latin America, you know better than me, the very rich people had access to all the information and the majority of the people did not. And with that comes power. And Fernando came with that idea. And I said, "We are democratizing. That is the beginning of the change in Latin America with the democratization of information." We invested in Star Media and we started to see all the entrepreneurs in Latin America were coming to us to see if we could invest in their ideas. Then after Fernando and Star Media, we invested in Patagon.com with Wences Casares and sold that to the Spanish. And Star Media did an IPO. And the most successful thing, more than any of our investments, was that more entrepreneurs came to our doorstep. Also, we had the opportunity to see all of them and select the best entrepreneurs because we already had a formidable reputation in this space and a reputation that we could add value to the ideas, to the investors. We sat on the boards of directors, etc. So Marco Scalperin, in that context, he knew a young person who worked with me and came to our doorstep. We were not looking for another investment, but we had seen De Remate. We had seen a company like Mercado Libre in Brazil because we were looking at all the business plans. We were looking at, I don't know, about 5 or 10 business plans a week. And this person who was working with us told me and Jerry that we had to meet Marcos. I don't know if it was in New York or we went to Buenos Aires, but I met Marcos and we said, "We must invest in this company because Marcos and Hernan are exceptional as people." And I will say that they had an organization that they brought to the table that was exceptional.
People with a different idea and a spectacular organization. That's how you get $7 million to start a company. In the next chapter of Climbers and Scalers, we will find out how different people also have alternative plans in case things don't go as expected.